America fought a revolution to not have power concentrated at the top. That led to a robust middle class. What happens when that middle class shrinks, though? This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton speaks with an author of The Middle Class Crisis and the U.S. Constitution. That conversation starts now.
Hello, and thanks for listening. Economic policy is tied to political policy. There's just no way around that. But we are going to try and separate out as much politics as we can for this discussion about America's middle class and the quantifiably growing income inequality. Economics is also called the dismal science because of its tendency to tease out the most depressing possible outcomes. A shrinking middle class is one example, and separating politics, which these days is synonymous with partisan politics, is also a dismal task. Statistics can be bent to lean, after all. But when one considers the U.S. Constitution, it's a blueprint for a combination of foundational political institutions as well as economic institutions. There's little daylight between the two disciplines. This week, we host a professor slash economist slash author to discuss his book about how hollowing out the middle class could end the American experiment.
One commentator has called this the doom loop of oligarchy, because once there's wealthy and powerful people who decide to start using government to support their own interests, it just creates a vicious cycle in which they can create laws that help them, and that makes them wealthier and allows them to create new laws that help them even more.
The concepts of oligarchy and even plutocracy have been tossed around a lot kind of recently, so we're going to ask about that as well. So here we go.
Ganesh Sitaraman, professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School.
And the author of The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Professor, thank you so much for your time today. Before we get started, let's form a baseline, okay? Would you give me your working definition of middle class constitution, and then we'll dive deeper into the contents of the book.
Great. So for most of history, people were very, very worried about the problem of economic inequality in societies. They worried that if there was a deep divide between rich and poor, the rich would oppress the poor, or the poor would try to confiscate the wealth of the rich, and the result would be violence, strife, and revolution. And so the answer to this problem for much of history was to build economic class right into the structure of government. So in ancient Rome, you have a patrician senate for the wealthy and a tribune of the plebs, the plebeians, for the poor. In England, we have a House of Lords for the wealthy, a House of Commons for everybody else, for ordinary commoners. And I call those class warfare constitutions because they try to tame economic inequality and class warfare by building it right into the structure of government. Now, the title of my book, The Middle Class Constitution, is something different. It's a constitutional system that assumes that a society won't have deep economic inequality, and so as a result, you don't need things like tribunes of the plebs or houses of lords. And in fact, I argue that our Constitution, the American Constitution, is one of these middle class constitutions. We don't have a tribune of the plebs. We don't have wealth requirements for being a senator or wealth maximums on being a congressman. We assume in our constitutional structure that we're going to have a relatively equal population. And that is what's under threat today as we see rising inequality.
There are so many different ways we could go here, but I want to start with where are the most immediate pressures that are squeezing the middle class? We've seen this and felt this being built, and it seems to be almost at a critical point, an inflection point right now.
So there's a variety of factors that have resulted in the squeeze of the middle class over the last 40 years or so. Some of these things are things we think about in the economy. So increased interconnection and competition from abroad, changes in technology, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about. But other things are actually policy shifts. One of the things that I think is very striking is we don't think enough about how much it makes a difference what the policy structures are for shaping the economy. And the important thing is in a democracy, we get to pick our policies. So prior to about 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago, we actually had a pretty extremely high tax rates, top marginal tax rates in the era right after World War II. We've massively slashed those. That means the wealthiest people get to keep more of the income that they take in. We had a much more robust estate tax than we do today, and that means that intergenerational wealth is different than it used to be. We used to have a much more robust antitrust system where we'd break up big companies and restrict the amount of consolidation in the economy. economy, so there'd be more competition. And what that meant was greater innovation. It meant more opportunity for small businesses, more opportunity for people to become owners and to be part of the middle class. So there's a lot of different areas. I'll actually throw in one more, which is the power of labor unions. You know, one of the striking things is that throughout history, labor unions have been one of the leading forces for economic opportunity and equality and justice for all people, not just members of their own unions. And so the decline and assault on labor unions over the last 30 or 40 years has also been part of the story. So there's a lot of different policy things that have helped create the crisis that we're in right now.
The most recent research around unionized labor in America that I can find is 7 to 8% of the existing labor force is unionized. And that is an upward pressure on wages and other situations, as you just mentioned. Is that similar to what your data is, 7 to 8%?
The most recent I thought was it was around 10%, so that's about right. But I think what's striking is that, you know, coming out of World War II in the 1940s, early 1950s, you know, the number was 30%. One-third of the American workforce, just around one-third of the American workforce, was part of a union. And what that meant was that they were part of a community. It meant they could bargain for higher wages, better benefits, safer workplaces, reasonable hours and schedules, and a lot of other things that meant that there was a bargain between corporations and their workers, that both of them, not just the owners of the corporation, not just the shareholders, not just the top managers, but that everybody would benefit from the productivity and gains that the corporation made.
Right. The stakeholders were on both sides of the aisle, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's been a real shift, is we had kind of an agreement. You know, some people called it the Treaty of Detroit, because it started in Detroit with the car companies, and the car companies and the unions got together and they made a deal. They were going to share the profits and gains of the company, so that meant workers would do better and that the shareholders and managers would do better. You know, I think that's something that's really broken down over the last 30 to 40 years.
You know, I'm a little bit emboldened by your previous answer, because in my notes I wrote that it seems that the growing zeitgeist since the 80s has been for America to create a handful of billionaires. But it seems to me it was originally to foment the creation of thousands of millionaires. Am I way off base there?
I think it's gotten worse over time. So, you know, there was a shift to really reshape the structure of our economy. And, you know, the proponents of the shift said that this was about capitalism and free markets. But one of the consequences of that is to not completely deregulate, but to actually shift where regulation happens, to shift who's powerful. And so instead of people being able to exercise control over the kind of society they want to live in through democracy, through passing of laws, what you have is bigger and bigger companies. And those companies then over time can use their power and influence to influence government. And that means they can use it to create rules in government that help their own interests. And that furthers this cycle. One commentator has called this the doom loop of oligarchy, because once there's wealthy and powerful people who decide to start using government to support their own interests, it just creates a vicious cycle in which they can create laws that help them, and that makes them wealthier and allows them to create new laws that help them even more. Yes. And so the thing becomes harder and harder to change over time.
In your book, you use the O word there, which is a great segue into my next question, because it seems you're arguing that if we're not careful, there will be an oligarchy, but I would argue that there's possibly already an oligarchy in place. I could be overstating that because I don't have your depth of knowledge, but it seems like since Eisenhower's warning on his way out of office, it continues to bear fruit in other industries like finance when it comes to the relationship between government and industry. Is there not already an oligarchy in place?
So your intuitions are similar to many, you know, to at least some political scientists who study oligarchy and have written about this, who argue that America is already an oligarchy, because what we have is not a system of government that is responsive to the people and representative of the people, but a system of government that's responsive to a smaller number of very, very wealthy people and interests. And that in that system, that's just not what a republic is. That's not a representative democracy anymore if you're only responsive to a small set of people. It's an oligarchy. I think that's a real problem for us now, is that our politics have become so unresponsive to where and what people actually want.
You spent a good time in the book talking about plutocracy as well. Could you help me just real quick with working definitions for the listener between oligarchy and plutocracy?
For most people talking today, in our casual conversation, there's really not much of a difference between the two. You know, when we talk about plutocracy, we're talking about government by the wealthy. When we talk about oligarchy, we're talking about a kind of, officially you would say, a small group of people having control over a country, and it has negative connotations to it. In both cases, these days, most people think of these as pretty similar, and we talk about oligarchy as tied into wealth. It doesn't have to be, but it tends to be the case that when you have that kind of system, the people who are ruling who are most influential are wealthy as well.
Okay, thank you for that. Professor, you also spent a good amount of time, and I found a great question I hope that you can help me answer here. Is there a parallel or a lesson to be drawn from the market concentration of the Industrial Revolution that you see or saw in America in your research and our contemporary situation of digital revolution or digitalization? Is that market concentration similar, or can we extrapolate anything from that?
So I think it's very similar, and I actually even push it a little bit farther than what you said, which is it's not just about technology. It's actually in every sector. So if we go back to a little bit more than 100 years ago in the Gilded Age, there was a period of time that scholars call the Great Merger Movement from 1895 to 1904. Hundreds of companies disappeared in America as mergers took over and created these massive conglomerations. And this was a period that worried a lot of people because there were large corporations that had extraordinary power, not just over entire sectors of the economy, but also over politics, and were able to bribe people to get their person elected senator, bribe officials to get policies passed, and so on. And this was seen as a real threat, not just to our economy, but also to our constitutional system. And so these kind of monopolies and trusts, you've maybe heard the phrase of Teddy Roosevelt as a trust buster, mm-hmm. comes from this period, were a real problem for people at the time. And what they argued was that you had to do a couple things. The first is you had to have a robust antitrust system. And antitrust, in its basic sense of it, we can think of as breaking up these big conglomerations of corporate power and wealth, so that there's smaller businesses, more competition that goes on in our economy. That's one kind of model. But another thing that they noted is that in a lot of areas, there's actually serious network benefits from certain kinds of industries like the telephone, the telegraph, way back then, railroads, or other kinds of utilities like electricity. And so for that, they said, you know, you need to have a kind of public utility model where either we do direct public provision of some of these goods, or these are regulated because, you know, you have a big network good and that makes sense for it to be regulated and to stay a monopoly. I think a lot of those principles you're now seeing resurgent today. We're in another era of massive economic concentration. It's not just in the technology space. It's pretty much in every sector of the economy, whether you talk about pharmacies or hospitals or pharma companies, beer companies. Pretty much in any sector that you look in, you know, there's a handful of firms or fewer that have massive amount of share over the entire market. And what that means is there's really not that much competition. And so people now are very interested in questions of, do we need to revive our antitrust laws and be more aggressive about them? You even hear people saying, you know, some of the social networks or other online resources are or should be considered as utilities and thought of in those terms. So I think we're at a moment where people are reviving a lot of the tools from the progressive era precisely because a lot of the problems seem very similar.
Couple of great things in that answer I want to pick on. But first, I want to ask you a little follow-up, because it seems the antitrust legislation and laws we have in place right now is not really applicable to the 21st century economy. And those were built to protect consumers. I don't hear anybody griping about Amazon offering really great prices and quick delivery on stuff. It seems to me that if you want to use antitrust on this, you have to use marketplace competition and the suffocation of that. If you break up these tech companies, it would oxygenate a market. That's one thesis that I kind of stick to. Where am I on your scale?
So these laws, which are kind of core antitrust laws, are actually from this Gilded Age progressive era. They're far older. But one of the reasons why that's important is that they're actually also more applicable than you would think to today. If you look at our antitrust laws, they don't actually say anything about consumer prices. That's actually an invention of the 1970s and thereafter, as part of a movement to really restrain what antitrust was about. So antitrust in its original formulation and through much of its history in America has has been about competition. It's been about power, both economic power in the market, but also political power, and the need to sustain a democratic society and a democratic economy. And so that was a big part of our rules. And over the last 40 years, we've really been pushed into narrowing our conception of what antitrust is and seeing it as something limited solely to consumer prices or consumer welfare, when that really wasn't the conception of these laws and of the field. One of the ways to think about it now is you don't have to think about it in those terms. It really is about competition more broadly. The Federal Trade Commission can regulate unfair competition, and that's their charge. And so there's actually a lot more space in our statutes than I think many people think, and they're a lot more applicable than people think. Part of our biggest problem is we don't have regulators who've really wanted to use the tools at their disposal to actually enforce the antitrust laws in a more serious way. And that's not to say that we couldn't do more with different kind of statutes, or that we couldn't have, you know, more readily tailored statutory solutions to modern problems. But actually, what we have is pretty workable if we really use it to their full extent.
Well, thank you for disabusing me of that assumption, Professor. I appreciate that, because that's going to help round me out for the next conversation I have about this. I had another author on. He's not an economist or a lawyer or a historian. He's a market analyst. But he said something that stuck with me, and I wonder if you would listen for a second. He says, tell me how big a country's middle class is and how many women are in its colleges, and I'll tell you how healthy its economy is. Is that too broad of a stroke for you?
I would want to think about that a little bit, but that sounds not bad to me. That sounds pretty good and a pretty reasonable way to think about how the economy works. I mean, I think one of the real challenges that, you know, we've had in the last 30 or 40 years is there's a set of beliefs that tend to think that, you know, if the wealthiest people are doing well, the prosperity will just trickle down to everybody else. And that's just not how an economy works. An economy works really well when lots of people in the middle are doing well. And part of the reason is when ordinary people have money, they can buy things. When they don't, they can't. And when people are able to buy things, that means that they're spending, and that's more jobs for other people who are the ones making those things or selling those things. And so the kind of productive cycle of a good economy is partly about having a robust and large middle class, and that's something that needs to be inclusive.
You introduced a character I'd never heard of before. Could you just give me a quick answer to Thaddeus Stevens?
So Thaddeus Stevens, one of the, in some ways, most creative and unsung heroes in our history. It was one of the Republicans after the Civil War who was really pushing for Reconstruction to be something robust. And I'll come back in a second to how this ties into the broader story of inequality. But, you know, what Stevens thought was that you couldn't have a real republic unless you had both civil rights and political justice, but also you needed economic justice. And so he fought for the freed slaves of the South, not just to get political rights and civil rights, but also to have economic justice and a stake in the economy. And so what Stevens proposed at one point was confiscating the land from the top 10% of Confederate planters and redistributing that land to their former slaves in 40-acre parcels. This is the era where the phrase 40 acres and a mule comes from. Mm. And the reason why was Stevens didn't think that you could have a landed aristocracy in a society and have that be a real republic, a real democracy. And so through this act, he would try to get rid of both the landed aristocracy and the landless class of poor, now former slaves. And that's a really important thing because I think, you know, right now we spend a lot of time, there's a lot of commentary about whether issues are about economics or about race. And the answer is they're about both, and they're connected in deep ways. And if we really want to have a middle class democracy, we need to make sure that everybody is part of the middle class and is able to participate in our democracy. And that's something that Stevens understood even way back at the end of the Civil War.
Professor, I have to sum up quickly. It's kind of like asking you to pick your favorite child. It's not a fair question. But at top of your punch list to help ease the crisis on the middle class right now, what would you suggest?
Well, I think there's a lot of things, but a couple of them I think are wages, antitrust, dealing with problems in student loans, and rebalancing our tax policy to make that more fair. I think those are a handful of things that I would say are pretty important on the economic side. And the other thing that I would say, though, is you can't just do the economic side. You have to do political reform in order to rebalance our political system. And so I think that means thinking about corruption, conflicts of interest, lobbying, and campaign finance reform. And unless we're really tackling all of those questions, it's very hard to end the kind of symbiotic relationship between a rigged political system and a rigged economic system.
Yeah, I think restoring balance, that's a heck of a punch list, but if we could restore balance using those we'd all be better off for it. Professor, thank you so much for your time. It's been an honor to speak with you this morning.
Thanks so much. It's a lot of fun.
That's Ganesh Sitaraman. He's a professor of law at Vanderbilt. He's also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution. For links to his work or anything else, please check out the show notes for this week. They live at KGORadio.com. Coming up after the break, we talk about the power of truth for women, including in the workplace. I talk with the author of Your Story is Your Power, Free Your Feminine Voice.
We take them through the culture and their family and also their personality to show where the blocks may be to being able to express that incredible intelligence.
That's coming up next, so please stick around. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Technomics.